Ready to find out more about France with some fun facts? I hope so, because one of my favourite things about living in France is discovering all the facts, stories and traditions that the French have. And there are plenty of them to keep me occupied. Now the French, they're a superstitious lot, and they've got some of the most random and bizarre superstitions, such as wearing clothes on Friday brings bad luck. Don't ask. Well, it's impossible to list everything that I have found over the course of the 7+ years that I've been living here, but I've gathered a few that I think you're going to enjoy. But before we dive in, I do want to remind you to go to lifeinruralfrance.com/podcast, because you will then be able to find links and pictures for everything that I talk about on this podcast. Plus, you'll better sign up for all the special offers I hear about, deals on hotels, tours, where to go, what I'm writing about, and so much more. Bonjour and welcome to the Life in Rural France podcast. I'm Kylie Lang, a British blogger living in the beautiful Charente region of rural France with my long-suffering hubby Richard and border collie Lottie. Now, unlike most people, moving to France hasn't always been my dream, but that didn't stop me jumping at the chance when hubby, who has never lived anywhere other than Leeds, England, suggested we go live in France. And 6+ years later, we're still here, living in a property we've renovated and a life that if you'd told me 10 years ago I'd be leading, I would not have believed you. But it's not all about me on this podcast. I'm going to be sharing the hidden gems I've discovered in France, some fascinating stories about French history, and plenty of culture thrown in for good measure. So I invite you to join me on this journey of living in a tiny French commune, getting to grips with learning French, singing to ABBA in the fields, walking my dog, and discovering the joys of the rural life. One thing I can promise you is it won't be boring, and who knows what we might discover together on this roller coaster ride of life in rural France. So it is a standing joke with my family that when I start a conversation with, "Did you know?" I'm likely to turn into a French encyclopedia and tell them all about my latest discovery. It's become like my catchphrase. My mum loves it and she actively encourages me to share, but I don't think hubby is quite as enthusiastic. I mean, he nods in the right places. He tries to arrange his face into what he thinks is an interested looking expression, but who knows what he's actually thinking about as I'm rattling off things such as, you know, what were the last words Marie Antoinette said before they lopped off her head? Or why do they celebrate the omelette every year in Béziers? Anyway, all that said, I have got some really fun facts about France to share with you that's hopefully going to get you smiling. And the first one, you've got to giggle at this one. Being a prostitute isn't illegal in France, but hiring one is. Oh, yes. Okay, so this little gem popped up when I was researching why Paris is called the City of Love. And if you want to know, you need to go to the website. Whole article on it. But you see, at the time of Napoleon III, prostitution wasn't illegal. It was highly regulated, but it wasn't illegal. So it was during a big period of change in France when Napoleon instructed housemen to modernize Paris. He wanted the slums cleared out. He wanted to rebuild Paris using the inspiration from the architecture and styles that he'd seen during his time in England. So this meant that all the prostitutes who were in the slums were moving out into other areas of the city. And of course, to do all this building work and renovation, it meant the city needed more workers. So Haussmann was bringing in workers from all over the place. And those workers were looking for, let's call it entertainment. So the French authorities adopted this system. And it was a system that basically controlled prostitution, that it licensed them, it health checked them. There were designated brothel areas known as maison close or closed houses. And this system was quite literally based on the belief that prostitution was a necessary evil that could be managed rather than eradicated. I mean, how forward thinking of the French. Anyway, even today, the act of prostitution itself isn't illegal. So this means individuals who sell sex aren't actually committing a crime by doing so. But on the flip side of it, France has got laws against purchasing sex. So this shift came into effect in April 2016 when the French National Assembly, they passed a law penalizing the clients of prostitutes. So as a client of a prostitute, you could land in jail with a hefty fine, but as a prostitute, you're absolutely fine. All right, number two. So there was a law stating you can't kiss on a train station platform. You couldn't write this stuff, could you? In 1910, there was a rule that was passed to prevent people kissing on a station platform in France. And it was actually one that came about because of practical reasons rather than moral ones. It wasn't about morality. And the issue was that the delays and disruptions that couples kissing caused in train schedules was really causing havoc. So couples were taking their time to say their farewells. They were prolonging kisses and all this was causing a delay. Now, bearing in mind, this was 1910. You know, we've got World War One coming up. People wanted to take their time saying goodbye to people, but in typically French fashion, some of the train stations had a way around this. And the most famous one was Gare de l'Est in Paris. They had this designated area where couples could say their goodbye. It was known as the kissing zone. I love it. Nobody could tell me, you know, what would happen if you actually broke this particular law or actually how it was policed. But I'm happy to say it's no longer enforced, so you don't need to panic. You can have a good old snog on the train platform if you want to. Okay, so on to one that's more about history, which of course I love being a history girl. So number three, the Hundred Year War wasn't actually 100 years at all. It was 116. So really should have been called the 116 Years War. Anyway, it actually spanned from 1337 to 1453. And it was essentially a series of conflicts that was fought between England and France. And there was various allies on both sides. But primarily, it was all over claims by the English monarchy to the French throne. So the roots of the Hundred Years' War can be traced back to really some very complex feudal ties and disputes over territories. You see, back in those days, France wasn't the entire country that it is now. It was broken down into these territories, and there was different feudalities and different claims to these different territories. But the most direct cause was the claim to the French throne by Edward III of England, and it was following the death of Charles IV of France in 1328. That's where it all began. Now, according to French succession laws, the throne couldn't pass through the female line. Now, that's not so unusual because it was the same in England. It wasn't the same in Spain, but it was the same in England. So this actually excluded Edward III because he was Charles IV's nephew through his mother. So therefore, that wiped out his claim to the throne. This in turn led to the ascension of Philip VI. Now, he was the first king of the Valois dynasty. And then Edward's subsequent claim to the throne sparked the conflict. So that's how it all came about. Now, as someone who loves history, how could I leave it there? Because this war can actually be broken down into phases, which helps you to understand why it wasn't 100 years, it was 116. But it still, you know, it goes way over that. So the first part was the Edwardian era. So this was 1337 to 1360. And there was quite a few early English victories here, such as the Battle of Crecy. Then you've got the Caroline War, which was 1369 to 1389. That was that period. And it was named after Charles V of France. So this was the phase which it saw quite a lot of recapture by the French. So they managed to get back a lot of the territory that they'd lost earlier. They adopted some new military tactics. Then you've got the Lancastrian War, which was 1415 to 1453. So this period included Henry V of England, and it was that famous victory that he had at Agincourt in 1415, and then the subsequent Treaty of Troyes in 1420. So it disinherited the French heir in favour of Henry V, marrying Charles VI's daughter, Catherine of Valois. So there's a lot going on here. And the tide turned with the rise of Joan of Arc, who we've all heard of, who got famously burnt at the stake. So that was that period in time. And the war officially ended in 1453 with the French recapturing Bordeaux. And all that left was Calais. Calais was the last English possession in France. And that remained under English control until 1558. So, you know, another 100 years later. So there you go. Now you know, a little history lesson there for you. Number four. I love this one. France holds the record for the shortest reigning monarchy. So I thought Lady Jane Grey of England was going some because she only lasted 9 days. But it was even shorter for Louis Antoine. And he was the son of Charles X. So you know what? You've just got to laugh. You couldn't write this. It is the briefest reign in history, 20 minutes. He ascended to the throne in 1830 and abdicated 20 minutes later. He was technically the king the moment his father abdicated, but he never officially ruled. He didn't perform any act as king, so it's known as the 20-minute reign. Although he did acknowledge his father's abdication, I think for Louis Antoine, he knew it was futile trying to claim the throne under the set of circumstances that he was faced with. So he abdicated himself in favour of his nephew, Henry York, Duke of Bordeaux. So yeah, Louis Antoine reigned famously for 20 minutes. Number five. French wasn't actually the official language in France until 1539. There you go. France in the Middle Ages, as I said earlier, wasn't how we know it now. The land was split, it was divided, and each region had various dialects and languages. So you had Occitan, you had Breton, you've got Basque, you've got Franco-Provençal, and several others as well. Before 1539, French, the language, was primarily confined to the Île-de-France region, which is all around Paris. So the court, the nobility, they spoke French, but it was other languages and dialects that dominated all the other regions. And oddly enough, from 1066, the time of William the Conqueror, French was the main language spoken in England, right up until the end of the 14th century. And a lot of this, I have to mention her, was down to my favourite lady, Eleanor of Aquitaine. I do have a bit of a girl crush on her. I mean, who wouldn't? She was amazing. So she married Henry II. It was her second husband. So both of them were French. And when Henry came to the throne in England, they ensured that French was the dominant language in England. You know, both of them hailed from France. And even when Richard the Lionheart, who was their son, their third son who ruled, he spent more time in France than he did in England when he was king. So England very much spoke French. And if you listen to a lot of our words, you can tell that they derived from the French language. Okay, this is such a funny one. Number six, the Parisians hated the Eiffel Tower when it was first built. So the Parisians hate anything that they think doesn't fit in with what they like. When the Eiffel Tower was completed in 1889, it was done for the World Fair, and it marked the centennial celebration, actually, of the French Revolution as well. It was not popular, and it faced significant criticism from most Parisians, especially the city's artistic and intellectual lot. They really hated it, and they just thought it was an eyesore. It clashed with the traditional architecture and landscape of Paris because, okay, so now it doesn't look like that to us. We're used to all sorts of odd, different architecture, but the tower, it has an iron lattice structure. It was a really stark departure from, you know, the stone facades and the ornate detailing that really define Paris's aesthetics at that time and still do. So a group of leading figures, which included Charles Gounod and Alexandre Dumas-Fee, they penned a letter of protest, and it became known as the Artists' Protest, and they sent it to the newspaper Le Temps. They called the tower useless and monstrous. They claimed it overshadowed Paris's historic monuments and that it was a barbaric mass. I love it. So dramatic. But it was only ever intended to be temporary. And it was supposed to be dismantled after 20 years, but it ended up being popular despite that initial backlash. Oh, how fickle the public can be. Because now the Parisians, they wouldn't be without it. Number seven. Ah, this is a great stat. Here we go. This is a good one. For did you know there are 45,000 chateaus in France? Well, that's not an exact number, but it's thereabouts. This just sends me into a French history frenzy. Now, if I could, I'd visit all of them. And I'm certainly doing my best at the moment. And it's one of my favorite things to do. I love going to Chateau. And a tour of the Loire Valley. Oh, it's up there on my list. It's one I've not done yet. I've not been here long enough. I've spent a long time exploring Bordeaux, Paris, Strasbourg, and places like that, but I've not yet done the Loire Valley. Now, many of the earlier chateaux, they were actually built as fortified castles in the medieval period, and they were primarily designed for defense against invaders, and they usually feature very thick walls, you know, so there's still a lot of walled chateaux left in France. Some of them have double wall fortification. They've got moats, towers. And then during the Renaissance, French chateaux, they kind of evolved and they became more symbols of power and wealth. And they focused more on elegance and comfort rather than defense. And so the style, the architectural style, just it really shifted. And you find a lot more elaborate gardens. There was more emphasis on symmetry and proportion. And of course, all these beautiful ornate decorations that you wouldn't have seen in the medieval versions. And then during the 17th and 18th centuries, you really saw this emergence of more classical styles. I mean, think the Palace of Versailles. That's probably the most famous example I can think of, as it just emerges into something so much more. Number 8, the nickname for France is dun, 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 Lexicon. So when you look at a map of France, its borders roughly sketch out to a hexagon. And that's where it got its nickname from. So to the north, it borders Belgium and Luxembourg. To the northeast, you've got Germany. To the east, Switzerland and Italy. And then to the southeast, Monaco and the Mediterranean Sea. And then if you go to the south, you've got Spain and Andorra. To the west, you've got the Atlantic Ocean. And of course, to the northwest, the English Channel. Number 9. This shouldn't be a shock to anybody. France is the most visited country in the world. Shocker. To be honest, I'm just not surprised. You know, you just have to look at the cities, the culture and the history to see why. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I come from England, so I'm used to history. There's, you know, history on every corner, although not in the same way as in France. But then I've also lived in Australia. Now, Australia doesn't have the same history. If you say you've been to see a house that's 120 years old, that's old in Australia, not, you know, centuries and centuries and centuries. The same in America. But France, I mean, think about it. It's home to the best bread in the world. It's got more cheese than you can shake a stick at. Actually, over 400 varieties. And don't even get me started on the wine. So that one really for me, number 9, is a given. Number 10, I'm going to say this very tongue-in-cheek. The cock is a national emblem in France. Now, I love this fact. And for those of you who don't know, I live in Chaix-le-Coq, which always makes my friends snigger. They're so childish. But actually, it's a fact I'm proud of. So much so, everybody is where we live. Everybody in Chaix-le-Coq has their own version of a cockerel, me included. I bought mine last year when my mum was over. And for some reason, it made her collapse into fits of giggles. My poor cock wasn't happy. How could she laugh at him? How rude. Anyway, just like me, the Gallic rooster is apparently a symbol of vigilance and bravery. I like to think of myself in that way. And apparently this is because roosters crow at dawn. And that symbolizes the start of a new day and dispels darkness and uncertainty. You know, I do like to think of myself as doing the same thing with this podcast. I'm bringing a little sunshine and sparkle into your day, just like the Gallic cock. So there you go. Anyway, number 11, moving swiftly on. Every region in France has a regional accent or dialect. Now, we did touch on this earlier when we were talking about the French language not coming into France and being the main language till the 16th century. Now, this one is a biggie. And it's not to say we don't have dialects in England, for example, because we do. Oh, but in France, it does my head in. So it's no great secret I struggle with my French. I have 2 lessons a week to try and help me, and I'm still not fluent. But the dialects are a bloody nightmare. So Claude, the farmer at the top of our street on Chaix-le-Coq, oh my God, he has a very broad Charente accent. And it's known, it's not even just an accent, it's a dialect. They use different words. It's known locally as Le Patois. Luckily for me, He generally sticks to talking about the weather when he sees me, which I can just about handle. And I did want to try and find out exactly how many dialects there are in France, but I never actually got a definitive answer, so I'll keep looking on that one. Number 12. Oh, I do love a bit of trivia. To view every single piece of art in the Louvre would take you 200 days. Now, I found this little beauty a few months ago when I was writing about how to visit the Louvre. So get this, if you were to spend just 30 seconds admiring each piece of art in the Louvre, and if you did that for 8 hours a day without a break, it would take you approximately 200 days to see everything. And that doesn't even account for the time spent moving between the exhibits. That is some stat. But here's a few more that might blow your mind as well, because they blew mine. The Louvre houses more than 380,000 objects. It displays over 35,000 works of art in 8 curatorial departments. It covers an area of 72,735 square meters of exhibition space. And the museum's galleries stretch over several miles. So walking through all the rooms without stopping would already take several hours. Cool, isn't it? All right, time to move on to some food facts, my favourite. So number 13, the croissant doesn't come from France. Now we are going to talk about this in much more detail in an upcoming episode, one where I'm going to take you on a trip to a French boulangerie. So make sure you tune in for that one. But here are the basics of where the croissant actually comes from. So it was in the 17th century, Vienna in Austria was under siege from the Ottoman army, and the bakers of the city, they could hear their enemies digging underneath the city, and so they alerted the authorities. This led to the Ottoman, as in the enemy's, plans of attack being foiled, and because of this, Vienna managed to win back the city. Like I said, that's the short potted version. But here we go. To celebrate their victory, those bakers came up with a special pastry and they shaped it like a crescent, because the crescent was the shape on the Ottoman army flag. And that's where it came from. And it said that Marie Antoinette was the person who bought this delicacy with her when she came from Austria to France to marry the Dauphin. So apparently she was so homesick when she first arrived that she asked the chefs at the Palace of Versailles to make her some Kipferl, which is the Austrian name for crescent. And that is how the croissant came to France. Number 14, macarons weren't invented in a French patisserie. So whilst we're at it, and because it's National Macaron Day on March the 20th, you should also know that macarons actually originated in Arab lands, although the Italians claim them. So it was when the Arabs made their way to Sicily and invaded that the Italians decided to take on their own version of macarons from the Arabs. But it was the Arabs that brought it to them in the first place. And the word macaron is derived from the Italian word mascherone, which means fine dough. So the initial version of the macaron didn't come from France. It was actually thought to be introduced to France by Catherine de' Medici's Italian pastry chefs. She brought those with her from Italy when she married Henry II of France in the 16th century. I have a whole article on macarons if you're interested. Just go to the blog, lifeinruralfrance.com, and type macaron into the search box and it will pop up. Number 15, there is a festival to celebrate the asparagus. I know, it's hilarious. But honestly, the French have more food festivals than any other country I know. You've got the truffle festival, the onion festival, the strawberry festival, the omelette festival. You've got the garlic festival. I mean, there's just festivals coming out of your ears. I think for every single form of food, there is a festival. But this one particularly tickles me, the festival of the asparagus. And it's held at the end of April in Blaye. And if you go, you'll see a variety of asparagus I'd never come across until I came to France. White asparagus. I'm not actually a fan, to be honest. I've had them a few times now. I also had them in Berlin when I went there. But they're just not as nice as green ones. They don't do it for me. But the fact is, there is a festival to celebrate all things asparagus. And it goes on all weekend. There's cooking demonstrations, live music, all to celebrate the harvest of the asparagus. So now you know. Number 16. Oh, this is a good one. French gastronomy was listed as a UNESCO World Heritage in 2010. So we all know the French are very proud of their food, as they should be. And in 2010, French gastronomy was inscribed on UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage List. So basically what that means is the recognition was to highlight the unique cultural significance and heritage of French culinary traditions. That's what it's really about. It's not for specific dishes or ingredients, but it's for the gastronomic meal of the French. And they were the first country to receive this award. So it's official. French food rocks. Number 17, and the final fact on my list, the French consume, get this, drumroll please, 130,000 tons of oysters every single year. That's insane, isn't it? See, oysters really are an integral part of French cuisine and culture, and that goes into overdrive during the festive season, so Christmas, New Year. That's when their consumption just peaks. But annually, they consume an impressive 130,000 tons. Now, I don't live far from La Rochelle, and that's one of the main areas for really good quality oysters. They have the Marennes oysters there. But I have to admit, I'm just not a fan. I've tried them in a variety of ways and I just can't stomach them. In fact, my worst oyster experience was at my hubby's walking football Christmas do. I know everybody laughs when I say walking football, but it was at this Christmas do a couple of years ago. So, I mean, the worst part of this was the actual meal didn't start till 9 o'clock at night. My poor little tummy. Anyway, by the time we sat down, the first course was oysters. And I made the stupid mistake of telling them I'd never had oysters before. And I kid you not, almost the entire room turned around to watch hubby and I receive our oysters. It was almost like, you know, they were waiting with bated breath. So I think, oh my God, I'm going to have to take one for the team. I can't say no. It will be really offensive if I do. So I had five. Hubby had five. And you just literally, I had to close my eyes, swallow, and then dig into this horrible little vinegary salad I'd been given as well. It was just gross. All I could taste was seawater. So I just don't get it. My French friend Anne thinks I'm insane. She can't get enough of them. Each to their own, I guess. But there are some other renowned oyster regions as well. So you've got Brittany, Normandy, Arachon Bay near Bordeaux. But I think I'm probably a little bit biased because La Rochelle, Ile de Ré, Ile de Léron, those are all big, big oyster places. And I've seen some of the oyster huts and what have you as well, in Royanne as well. So there you have it. As I said at the start, there are too many wacky French facts to list them all, but I think this highlights a really good mixture to get you started. Now, maybe you know some great ones that you want to share. And if you do, I would love you to email them to me at podcast@lifeinruralfrance.com and tell me a fun fact you think we should know about, and I will read it out on the podcast. So next week, our episode is all about the fascinating life of Marie Antoinette. Or more accurately, it's the facts you didn't know about Marie Antoinette. For example, what were the words she uttered before they chopped off her head? And why did they wear a different pair of shoes every day in the Versailles court? You will find out all this and more next week. So make sure you tune in to find out. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Life in Rural France podcast. Remember to visit lifeinruralfrance.com/podcast to get notified every time I release a new episode. And if you enjoy the podcast, I'd love you to leave me a review and subscribe. And don't forget to send in your questions for Listener of the Week, where I answer your questions about France in the show. So until the next time, I hope I filled your life with a sprinkle of French sunshine and a lot of French fun.